Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
All Hillary Clinton has to offer is more of the same. More taxes, more regulations, more bureaucrats.
Cut taxes slash regulation. That's the heart of the economic plan Donald Trump laid out today. Would it work? Just look at what the states have already done, says a Yale economist. He's run the numbers on red and blue states to see where there's more prosperity. Also today, the difficult decision one woman made to stop chemotherapy after 13 years.
I've lived life by my rules and with my game plan, and I'm going to leave this world with me calling the shots as much as I can.
Plus, the Netflix series Stranger Things and the strange lure of 80s nostalgia.
Rush back to my place. Winter gets a comic.
Any comic?
Yeah. Hey! I didn't say go!
That's all next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and boy, I've been gone for a long time, so it's great to be back with you. Let's get right down to business. Donald Trump gave a major economic policy address in Detroit this afternoon, something of a reset for the Republican nominee after days of unrelenting controversy last week, though his speech today couldn't fully escape that controversy. Protesters interrupted Trump several times as he spoke at the Detroit Economic Club. Nevertheless, today Trump offered some new details on how he would boost the economy, saying he wants to, quote, jumpstart America. It can be done, and it won't even be that hard.
When we reform our tax, trade, energy, and regulatory policies, we will open a new chapter in American prosperity, which is so desperately needed. We need a new chapter.
So to start today, we're going to focus on two of those issues, taxes and regulation. Donald Trump says slashing taxes and ending regulations can revitalize the American economy as a whole. Well, it turns out we can already see the effects of differing tax policies and regulatory frameworks on prosperity within the 50 different United States themselves. They're an interesting economic laboratory, according to Yale political scientist Jacob Hacker. He's co-author of the new book, American Amnesia: How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper, and he joins us now from Yale. Professor Hacker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me, and I guess I should say welcome back.
I've just been sort of dancing on different shows and away for a while, but I'm glad to be back. So let me first ask you, let's just get right down to it. You looked at red states and blue states, you know, to roughly describe them. Are the policies that Donald Trump espoused today about slashing taxes and really reducing regulations, or do states that follow that prescription, are they more prosperous?
Well, the short answer is no. If cut and extract, as we call it, that is cut taxes and cut regulations, especially on extractive industries, was the key to prosperity, the distribution of income and wealth in the United States would be about opposite of what it is across the states. The richest states, the blue states, and they're not just richer in terms of income. They have better health. They have higher levels of education. They have more patenting activity, more research and development, lower rates of poverty, less lack of health insurance, more food security. I mean, you go down the list, it's actually pretty hard to find an indicator that looks better on average in red states than it does in blue states. And so
I just want to jump in here for a point of clarification. When you say red or blue states, how are you specifically defining them?
Yeah, so absolutely. I mean, that is the big question. And what we're really interested in here, since the states are, in a sense, a laboratory of policy, is what the state policies look like. And in an early version of this analysis, we looked at state economic policies, a broad index of state economic policies. But it turns out that correlates almost perfectly with the partisanship of states in recent presidential elections, which is a lot easier for people to understand. And so in the piece, we focused on the states, on the one hand, the blue states that had gone for the Democrat in the last four presidential elections, so since 2000, and on the other hand, the red states, the states that had gone for Republicans in the last four presidential elections, which essentially comprises of roughly 40 states. So there are 10 states that and they're familiar to us, they're the battleground states that fall in between. But I want to be clear that these differences in partisanship correlate very closely with differences in policies within the states.
Okay. Well, so let's just touch back on what Donald Trump said this afternoon for a second here and look at taxes specifically, because today he called for an end to the estate tax. He also called for an exclusion of childcare expenses from taxation, and he called for a 15% cap on all business income tax. Now, this, of course, would all be at the federal level. And he also called for reducing the current number of tax brackets from 7 down to 3. And then he said this.
I am proposing an across-the-board income tax reduction, especially for middle-income Americans. This will lead to millions of new and really good-paying jobs. The rich will pay their fair share, but no one will pay so much that it destroys jobs or undermines our ability as a nation to compete.
And he also mentioned ending the carried interest tax loophole, as he called it. But I'm wondering, when it comes to state level taxation, were the states with supposedly higher income taxes better off than those with lower?
They were not. If you just look across the states, the blue states are richer, and they generally have higher taxes on the well-off. You know, you could look at the total tax burden. You can look at the share of taxes paid by the top 1%. And I think the point is not that taxes are irrelevant. It's just that the much more important factors involve whether the states offer a conducive environment for innovation and investment. And the cities where this occurs, cities like San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Boston, are cities that have invested heavily in public education. They're cities that have had a long tradition of receiving federal research and development dollars. They're cities that attract highly skilled, highly educated workers. And so taxes matter, but what you do with those taxes matters probably even more.
Yeah. So this brings up a really interesting or major wrinkle, I would say, because you mentioned Boston. And as you know, the Brookings Institution earlier this year said that Boston, in terms of income inequality, is the most unequal city in the entire United States. So while, you know, all the things that you said about where the city chooses to throw its money and its support are true, it's also led to this other reality, which I think, you know, many people who are on the suffering end of that inequality, you know, they feel a lot of support, or they want to throw their support behind the policies of someone like Donald Trump.
Yeah, and there's huge disparities within states, too, between urban and rural areas, which I think is also a major factor that's driving Trump's support. But we note in the piece that the Achilles heel of this huge amount of wealth creation and innovation that's occurring is high levels of inequality. And it is true that on average, the blue states have higher inequality. It's worth noting that those states also do a lot more to offset inequality. They're more likely to have state-specific earned income tax credits, for example, or to expand Medicaid. So on balance, they may not be places that are more unequal when you consider those benefits. But the point is that the big issue, I think, in these places is that not only are people cash-strapped who are at the lower end of the income spectrum, but they're facing very high housing costs. And I think that's the real issue, housing affordability. It's an issue for our nation because if more and more of our total economic activity is taking place in these dense urban hubs, then we need to figure out how to get more people into them. And that means more high-rise housing. That means fewer restrictions that reduce the degree to which you can construct affordable housing. It means more investment in affordable housing. And we're not arguing in this piece that the blue states have it all figured out. There's a bunch of problems in blue states. I think our main point is that when you hear the politicians, particularly Republicans, saying, look, you know, look at the South, look at these red states, you're really missing the bigger picture. Prosperity is a result over the long term of investment in science and education, not just cutting taxes or pulling stuff out of the ground.
Yeah. So on that point, I mean, Donald Trump has spoken about his running mate's record in Indiana, for example. And you know, we were looking at some numbers during Mike Pence's tenure as governor of Indiana. He did reduce or the government there did reduce the state's income tax rate from 3.4% down to 3.3%. It's going to further drop to roughly 3.25% at the beginning of 2017. And the state also added almost 150,000 jobs between when Pence took office and May 2016. So, you know, there's an example of a red state, at least with those numbers, doing fairly well.
Well, and there's exceptions across the board on these things. But what we do know is that the states that have doubled down and pursued the most aggressive tax cutting strategies, states like Kansas and Louisiana, have not had very good outcomes. And it's very hard to compare the short-term trajectory of any state. I mean, so that's why in this piece, Paul Pearson and I really look at the sort of long-term development of all of these measures of prosperity, including health and education as well as income. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I think is most telling is that it used to be that the red states and the South in particular were converging dramatically with the rest of the nation. And since the 1980s, when we've become a much more knowledge-oriented economy, the opposite has been occurring. There's actually been growing divergence. We point out that, for example, Texas and Utah were very close to Massachusetts in terms of average income by the 1980s, and in the last 25 years, they've essentially fallen farther and farther behind.
Yeah.
So this is a really interesting part of the story. We basically we're seeing forces of divergence where we used to see forces for convergence, and we think a lot of it has to do with what a knowledge economy requires, namely education, investment, and innovation, and so on.
Well, so finally, Jacob Hacker, I'm just curious because I love the example of looking at the laboratories that are the 50 United States because I think there is a lot to learn from that. But how much can we really draw? Are we drawing the right kinds of lessons vis-a-vis what the states tell us when we apply it to the United States as a whole? Or is the playing field just different when we're considering the entire nation and changes that might be made at the federal level?
I think it is different. And it's really important to understand that as important as, you know, as critical as these state policies are, the federal government's policies, from monetary and macroeconomic policies to the specific things that it does to encourage education, are even more important. And that makes it even more striking in some ways that the states are diverging because the federal government's role is so important. And I think the federal government has a different role, that states are going to have to do a lot to attract business and highly skilled workers, whereas the federal government's role has to be to undergirding the basic system through investment in R&D and education and other kinds of prerequisites of prosperity.
Well, Jacob Hacker is a professor of political science at Yale University and co-author of the new book, American Amnesia, How the War on Government Led Us to Forget What Made America Prosper. Professor Hacker, many thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, Meghna.
And we'll take a close look at Hillary Clinton's economic plan, which is expected to be released by her a little later this week. But for now, let's take a quick break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Our Common Health segment this week is a deeply personal story that touches on life and death and parenthood.
I was a good parent before I had cancer. I became a better parent because of cancer, because you don't ever postpone.
That's Colleen Lum of Hopedale. She was diagnosed with stage 3 ovarian cancer 13 years ago. Now, after some 160 rounds of chemotherapy and after seeing her two children grow into adulthood, Colleen Lum has decided to stop treatment and prepare for her death. She spoke about her decision and her family as part of a collaboration between WBUR's Common Health and the nonprofit Health Story Collaborative.
As a parent, you would give anything to protect your children from these difficulties in life, but you don't get a choice and you've got to deal with them. And I'm much more of a believer, the more open and honest and straightforward and direct about it, the better you are, instead of creating pretend situations or illusions. We've always been straightforward and honest. We get the news, we get to process it,
But then they get the facts and the truth. And it's not mommy has a tummy ache. No, mommy has cancer. I think I was born an optimist and I was born a fighter. I've had so many really bad things happen, but I've always popped back and I've had 13 years of cancer with no pain. But it changes. 6 months ago, I was walking and hiking all over Italy and I felt like $1 million. And 2 months later, I'm leaving the hospital on oxygen 24/7. And I've just come off of a clinical trial that I don't think did me any good, and it probably did me harm. I've always hoped to have enough wisdom to figure out when the fight's over. And I've now decided to end treatment. And somebody's like, but you have to keep fighting. And I go, I will fight till the day I die. But the thing is, I'm doing everything I can to the best of my ability. But I'm losing. And I know that. I can't make my body do things it won't do. It's not breathing on its own, and it's not breathing well. When I can't eat, somebody's like, well, you can put a feeding tube in. And I'm like, over my dead body. Those things are not going to happen to me because I'm not going to die that way. And with the kids, once I told them I was going to stop treatment, they didn't say, well, gee, Mom, you have to keep on. You got to keep doing this. Because they understood. They've seen the difference. They know what my belief system is and my value system is. And once I made the decision that we're done, I haven't had a moment's doubt or regret. This is the right thing to do. It's like I've lived life by my rules and with my game plan, and I'm going to leave this world with me calling the shots as much as I can. If I got to call the shots, I get to hang around in bed and talk to the very last frickin' minute and kind of chop and go, hey, it's time to go. And I say goodbye and I'd walk out peacefully. But as with cancer and most things, I don't know how much of a choice I get in that. It's not the dying that upsets me. It's the milestones in your children's lives you're going to miss. Seeing them walk down the aisle or seeing them have babies. Getting cancer and dying from cancer sucks. But I don't know if I even look at myself as being unlucky. Everything in life I've ever wanted, I have. I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's. I've got the world's best husband. I got 2 great kids. And everything that's meaningful or important, I have. And the only thing I want from all of this is more time. And it's the only thing I can't have. And I get that. My greatest accomplishment in this world is my kids. I left the world a better place because of the human beings I brought into it and helped create. And they get full credit for what they accomplish and who they become. But this world is a better place because I helped mold them.
That's Colleen Lum. She was recorded in June, and she's currently in home hospice care. Now, Colleen's story was brought to us by WBUR's Common Health and the nonprofit Health Story Collaborative. And here with more is Carrie Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Meghna.
Wow.
I know.
It's difficult to know where to start because I'm still so taken by Colleen's courage and her humanity, really. I mean, I have to say, I haven't heard someone describe reaching this stage or the end of one's journey as she has. So just tell us a little bit more about Colleen and how we found her story.
Well, we found her through Dr. Annie Brewster. She's the head of the nonprofit Health Story Collaborative, which tries to sort of empower patients and help them feel not so isolated as they navigate their illness. And I asked her why she chose to tape Colleen, and she said that, first of all, Colleen, as you just heard, is just an incredibly inspiring person in the courage and the realness and the openness with which she faces her own death. And Dr. Brewster pointed out that that fits in with this big cultural shift that we're right in the middle of now, of trying to face this inevitable fact of life, our death, and talk about it more, have the end of life conversation. And Dr. Brewster points out that we're just not very good at this yet.
Some recent data showed that, you know, 90% of people acknowledge that end of life conversations are important, but really, in reality, less than 30% of people are actually having such conversations. In the same vein, while Medicare is finally, for the first time this year, reimbursing for end-of-life conversations between doctors and patients, less than a third of doctors are actually trained on how to have these conversations. So we really need to do some catch-up.
Boy, do we ever.
Yeah.
I mean, especially since another thing that Colleen's story brings to light is 160 rounds of chemotherapy, 13 years of treatment for ovarian cancer. I mean, how common is that? Is that duration getting more common?
Well, yes. So more and more cancer is sort of like a chronic illness that many of us live with. The latest numbers just out this summer are that there are 15.5 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and that's expected to rise to 20 million a decade from now. And it's better treatment, it's earlier diagnosis, it's that we're all getting older. But so Colleen's 13-year journey is the sort that a lot of us will be taking.
Okay, so this idea or the reality of what to do at the end of that journey, then mm-hmm. I keep coming back to, because of the way Colleen talked about it, the decision to stop treatment. But for her, she sounded, in a way, kind of a hopeful note that more patients can have that choice.
Right. You have that choice. You have your values. You're acting them out. And for me, one of the most striking things was that she very clearly had these milestones that she wanted to reach. She wanted to raise her kids. And she did last long enough to do that. And Dr. Annie Brewster says that milestones, you know, they do motivate patients, but the body also has rules of its own.
Sometimes, no matter what we want or no matter how hard we try, we can't get to those milestones. And she feels like she would want more than anything in the world more time, but she's also at peace with the fact that she can't have that and feels grateful for what she has had and all of the milestones she has been there for.
Which is just so striking, right? She's grateful for what she had. She wouldn't trade her life. And Annie says Colleen also told her that she was grateful to know that her friends and family will be there for her kids when she can't be.
Yeah. You know, speaking of her kids, I mean, I think that's the part that just really pulled at my heartstrings the hardest, because I can understand what Colleen meant when she said, like, she wanted to raise her kids to the point where their understanding of what was happening to her could mature, you know, because it's different. How can you have this conversation with an 8-year-old versus an adult child who may be in their 20s or 30s?
Right. And these kids understand. And I think one of the most heartening parts of this story is that you get the sense that they're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
Here's her daughter, Kiara.
We'll be fine because she was our mother. Like, the very fact that she raised us how she did and taught us from her experiences that being Kyle will be good.
So that just, Meghna, that made me think, Colleen, you did it. Yeah. You raised her. Yeah. You got there.
Well, I mean, you must have gotten a lot of responses on Common Health for this.
Yeah, you know, just when I thought I was done crying, I started reading the responses. I think the one that got to me most was somebody who wrote, "Those of us who stay behind miss our moms very much, but always carry them in our hearts."
Oh, absolutely. Well, Carrie Goldberg is editor of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can hear more of Colleen Lum's story. Share your own as well at our website. We've got a link to everything at radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks as always.
Welcome.
Let's switch gears now. A special fund designed to saving the Massachusetts horse racing industry has an unusual problem. It's got too much money and not enough places to spend it. The strange situation has created a turf war amongst owners of different breeds of racehorses over who should get the money and which group best represents the future of the ailing horse racing industry. WBUR, in collaboration with the investigative news organization The Eye, has been examining the Massachusetts Racehorse Development Fund. This morning, WBUR reporter Bruce Gellerman has the first story in our two-part Bostonomics series, trying to win, but no place to show.
Back in the 1930s and 40s, horse racing, the sport of kings, reigned supreme in New England. In its heyday, there were 17 thoroughbred racetracks in the region. Bob Temple, a New England horse racing historian, says the four largest brought in huge crowds.
Just those four tracks outdrew the Red Sox, the Bruins, and the Celtics combined. And that's how big the sport was.
But times and tastes have changed. Today, horse racing in Massachusetts is an also-ran sport. There's only one racetrack in the state still running on a regular schedule, and it's not even for thoroughbreds. These days, Bob Temple says bettors prefer quick-paced casino action over the ponies.
It's a dying industry. In fact, you might even use the past tense. It's a dead industry. It's almost non-existent. Why support a dying industry?
For the past year, horse racing in the state has been on government life support. A special subsidy, known as the Racehorse Development Fund, is administered by the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. Stephen Crosby is chairman.
The legislature has made the decision multiple times that it is in the public interest to save the horse racing industry for all of its associated dimensions.
Those include jobs, saving open space, and family farms. 5 years ago, lawmakers created the Special Horse Fund when they approved casino gambling. Many considered it a sure bet because the horse fund had a key backer in House Speaker Robert DeLeo. The Democrats' district in Winthrop is adjacent to Suffolk Downs Racetrack, where DeLeo's father worked for decades. DeLeo declined our repeated request to comment for this story. The fund has turned out to be a winner, at least financially. So far, it's raised nearly $24 million, a combination of one-time casino licensing fees and a tax on gambling. And as new casinos open, an analysis by WBUR and The Eye projects the horse fund will grow to more than $20 million a year. But historian Bob Temple says there's little evidence horse racing is making a comeback.
There's big money, and there's really not enough racing to support it. Where does all that money go to? Who's coming out ahead?
To find out, let's follow the money. The sound of 1,200 slot machines at Plain Ridge Park Casino is music to the ears of Penn National Gaming. The company owns and operates the state's only slot parlor. It's in Plainville, about an hour south of Boston. In its first year of operation, bettors dropped nearly $2 billion into the machines. Most of the money wagered, 92%, goes back to bettors as winnings. But the biggest winner is the Commonwealth. The state is guaranteed almost half the money after Penn National pays off slot players. Most of Massachusetts' share goes to local aid, but 18% of the gambling tax goes directly to the horse fund. In the year the slots have been up and running, the horse fund has already taken in $15 million. At Plain Ridge Park, what goes around comes around. Money down the slot machines comes around the racetrack attached to the casino.
$2 on number five. It's all about Mike.
To win?
Yep. Thank you.
To run the slot parlor, Massachusetts requires Penn National to run live racing at Plain Ridge Park. The slot machines at Plain Ridge take in over $5 million a day. In comparison,
the horses are approaching. Post on engage.
The money bet on live racing here is chump change.
Roughly, we're handling between 15 and 19,000 in-house a day.
Jason Savastano oversees the Plain Ridge track betting windows. It's here you can see the racehorse subsidy in action.
This field is in motion.
Most of the money from the slots that goes into the horse development fund is used to beef up purses. That's the prize money paid to owners of winning horses. The crowd outside on the rail, watching the horses trot by, is sparse, even today, free hat day. There's no admission charge, attendance isn't even counted. In fact, there are more people inside the clubhouse watching simulcast racing on screens than watching the real action just outside.
Everybody's pacers all in behind the gate.
Mutual manager Jason Savastano says you can bet on races broadcast from around the country.
That can get us around another 150,000 on top of that as well. Because that's so many more tracks combined.
How often pacing, there goes ALS.
These days, you don't even have to go to the track to watch races and bet. You can use an app on your smartphone. But there are some,
mostly an older crowd who still like to see the action live.
My name's Ed Nowak. I'm retired. And, well, I have a horse in this race, and I have another horse that races here.
What are the odds? By pure chance, right next to me was the president of the Standardbred Owners of Massachusetts.
Which horse do you have in here?
The six horse, 16-1, called Native Speed.
I don't try the first time, Native Speed on top by a length and a half.
Nowak's horse is the long shot. My bet, All About Mike, is the 2-1 favorite. Slot machines are pure luck, but picking a winning horse, factoring in past performances, track conditions, and considering the odds, that takes some skill. These are harness race horses, pacers and trotters, not thoroughbreds you see in the Kentucky Derby. In harness racing, drivers ride in small buggies called sulkies. As they round the track, the standardbreds look delicate, but these are powerful, 1,000-pound trained athletes that can thunder through a mile in under 2 minutes.
That was your horse.
Yes, it was. See, anybody can win at this game. You should buy a horse.
Ed Nowak can laugh now. Thanks to the fund, it's been a good payday at the races. His horse finished first and receives half the $3,700 purse, adding to Native Speed's six-year total.
He's won $72,000 since I bought him.
And how much you pay for this horse?
$5,500. So it's cost me $25,000 or $30,000 to keep him. So yeah, I've made some money.
But Nowak is lucky. Horse racing is a risky business. Costs are high, margins thin, and profits uncertain. And until the Racehorse Development Fund kicked in a year ago, Massachusetts' racing industry was on its last legs. The prize money paid by the track, pathetic.
I raced for an overall purse of $1,800.
Horse owner Bob Bogigan.
I won that race and I cleared $800 for my share. I didn't even cover expenses. We were finished.
But thanks to the infusion of $8 million from the casino tax subsidy this year, the standardbred side of the racing industry is stabilizing.
The Horsemen's Development Fund, it's worked out very well. And right now we're in a good place where we're going to get higher purses, and it will stimulate the entire life product.
But that's only because standardbred owners have a track where they can routinely compete for purses made fatter by the horse fund. Plain Ridge Casino is required to hold 115 days of racing this year and more next year. Thoroughbred horse owners are a distant second. Since Suffolk Downs Racetrack lost its bid for a casino 2 years ago, there have been only 9 days of racing scheduled there. So far, the only thing that's been saving thoroughbreds in Massachusetts is that they were getting 3/4 of the purse money from the state fund. The cut for standardbreds, those running at Plain Ridge, just 25%. The unequal split has bred contempt between the two groups of horse breeders and owners. About a month ago, the two sides went head-to-head before the state horse racing committee, which voted to dramatically change the split in favor of standardbreds, reducing the thoroughbred share of the fund from 75% to 45%. Frank Frizzoli represents the thoroughbred horse owners.
We were very disappointed with the vote here. I thought it might be appropriate to slightly reduce the percentage that went to the thoroughbred allocation, and I just think the committee went too far.
The decision was yet another setback for the state's thoroughbred racehorse industry, which is still looking for a permanent place to run. And even though not many fans show up at Plain Ridge Park, standardbreds have a track of their own, and harness racehorse owners will get millions of dollars more from the new split of the Racehorse Development Fund. Massachusetts Gaming Commissioner Stephen Crosby.
There is anecdotal evidence that the Racehorse Development Fund is having a positive impact on the harness racing side. The thoroughbred racing side is completely in chaos, you know, because nobody knows what's going to happen.
Tomorrow, chaos leads to infighting and a federal lawsuit as thoroughbred horse owners offer competing visions of a long-shot future.
That's WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. Our series, Trying to Win But No Place to Show, is produced in collaboration with the investigative news organization, The Eye. Bruce said you can hear part two tomorrow, and he is indeed correct, but you can also find a link to it right now at our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Okay, let's talk Olympic Games, because there is a lot to catch up on from the past few days. We've already seen USA swimmer Katie Ledecky shatter her own world record in the 400-meter freestyle. Michael Phelps showed he still has more gold medals in him yet, delivering a stellar performance in the men's 100-meter relay final. And gymnast Simone Biles is showing the world why she is the favorite to win the women's all-around final. But Brazil, of course, is also a nation still in the midst of some severe political turmoil, and evidence of that is on the streets of Rio outside the Olympic stadiums and arenas. Well, Boston Globe investigative sports reporter Shira Springer is our woman in Brazil for the Games, and she joins us now from Rio de Janeiro. Welcome, Shira.
Hello from Rio.
It's good to have you, Shira. Okay, I think I might have made a mistake. I said Michael Phelps performing well in the men's 100-meter relay final. Did I get that right or wrong?
It was the 4x100.
4x1. That's what I thought, because a relay can't just be 100 meters. My apologies for that. But that's why we've got you in Rio, to keep us on the ball about these things. How has Rio been so far?
Very interesting, both in the venues and outside the venues. It's a bit of a wild scene, you know, depending on where you are. I mean, we can start in the venues. I've gone to, I've been at the tennis, fencing, swimming, and gymnastics. I was there for the USA's qualifying in women's gymnastics yesterday. I was on hand last night at the swimming, too. But my interest was more in the Russian swimmer who is controversially competing in the Games after having been suspended for doping violations.
Well, let's talk about that, Shira, for a second, because, I mean, the Russian team and their ongoing massive doping violations and scandals is a part of the story of the Games here. So tell us more about that Russian swimmer.
Yeah, I'd say it's very much a part of the Games here. It's sort of overshadowing the competition in some way, because every time a Russian athlete competes in an event, they always get asked about how they feel about the reputation of their country and the fact that they weren't all banned from the Olympic Games, and then any of their competitors are automatically asked about how they feel about competing against Russians. Now, in the case of the 100-meter breaststroke, you have Yulia Isimova, and she was formally found guilty of steroid use, and it was thought that she would not be allowed into the Rio Games, but an appeal got her into the Games, and she is now competing against two Americans, Lily King and Katie Myrie, in the final, the 100-meter breaststroke tonight, for the gold medal, and the Americans are really her rivals, particularly Lily King, and suffice it to say, the Americans are not happy about having Isimova in their race, because they simply feel it's not fair. And now while they say, listen, we have to respect the International Olympic Committee's decision to allow her to compete, but it doesn't mean we have to agree with it.
Right. Well, let's move over to gymnastics for a moment and talk about 19-year-old Simone Biles. Her first Olympics, off to a terrific start, though.
Yeah, I think you can pretty much sum up Simone Biles' performance in one word: dominant. You could probably use the same word to describe USA Gymnastics: dominant. I mean, they are, you know, Simone is expected to win the all-around gold medal, and the U.S. is expected to take the team gold. It would be a shock if they didn't do that on both counts. And they, you know, in the qualifying, they got off to exactly the start that everyone expected them to get off to.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk for a moment about fencing, if we could, because
except
I have to say, people who don't want spoilers for the Olympics, because you haven't seen these events yet due to tape delay and things, plug your ears for the next 20 seconds, okay? So plug your ears, because we're going to talk about Ibtihaj Mohamed. She made her Olympic debut today. She's a saber fencer, eighth ranked in the world, the first athlete to compete for the United States wearing a hijab. So obviously that's significant, but her fencing ability first and foremost. But again, everyone, plug ears if you don't want spoilers, because Shira, how has she been doing?
I actually haven't seen the results come through. They haven't announced those.
Oh, okay, good. So
I think I said, don't worry about the spoilers. I think you're actually ahead of things here. So, but I will say that what's great about fencing is the venue itself. And we can avoid spoilers by just talking about the atmosphere. Of all the places I've been to, it has been by far the best, most festive atmosphere going in the Olympic Games. It has been absolutely spectacular. They play, you know, loud rock and roll music in between bouts. They have this terrific theatrical lighting where they spotlight the fencers in the medal matches. It's really been something to behold. Mm. And I think, you know, every time I go see fencing at the Olympic Games, I always wonder why it hasn't caught on and become a bigger sport in the United States, because it is so much fun on the Olympic level.
Yeah. Well, finally, Shira, before we wrap you up, we're really taxing the cell phone line here, but I do want to ask you, we mentioned that obviously there's still a lot of turmoil and tumult going on across Brazil regarding its own government. I mean, have you found evidence of that in Rio amongst the people that you've talked to? I mean, how is the city itself reacting to the games and the discontent that the folks there have had with Brazil's government vis-a-vis the games?
You know, I think what I've been noticing, first of all, there have been protests, and there were protests prior to the opening ceremony, and the torch relay actually had to be diverted from Copacabana Beach. It was supposed to run the length of the beach. It could not because of protesters. So there have been protests throughout the city, a lot of them prior to the games. I think the bigger concern as the games have gotten underway has been security. And I think that's the thing that really strikes you when you get outside. And actually, even inside the Olympic Park, is just the amount of visible security. Now, I've been to other Olympic Games and seen a heavy security presence, but this is by far the most visible. And not only is it visible, these guys aren't fooling around. There are military men with, you know, heavy machine guns, and they stand there with their fingers on the trigger as they are standing guard around the Olympic venues outside and about the Olympic Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the other thing that sort of is just an interesting, there was a stray bullet that actually made its way through the media tent at the equestrian venue. It's a very strange atmosphere because you go to these games and you're inside these venues and it seems just like any other Olympics. And then you come out of the venues and you see this heavy security presence and you hear about the bullet going through the media tent at the equestrian center and you're like, whoa, it's quite a bit different.
Definitely quite different. Today. Yeah, definitely. Well, Shira Springer, investigative reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe, giving us regular updates. She'll be doing that from the Summer Olympic Games in Rio. Shira, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, for legal and rights reasons, we can't actually play any sound from the events at the Olympics Games, but we can play some great Brazilian music. So this is 12-year-old MC Sofia. You saw her at the opening ceremonies. Here's another one of her tracks. Menina podem brincar de boneca. Hey, 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 ho, ho, ho. Olha lá, a menininha fazendo um monte de gol.
Respect to my push. Winner gets a comic.
Any comic?
Yeah.
Hey! I didn't say go!
I'll take your X-Men 1-3-4!
Stranger Things, the original Netflix sci-fi series full of 80s nostalgia, that synthesized music, kids on bikes, Dungeons and Dragons, you heard X-Men mentioned there too. It rocketed to number one digital original series in the first week of its release last month, 44 million views. That's according to numbers from Parrot Analytics, or a company that measures global content demand. So joining us now with more is Ethan Gilsdorf. He's here to talk about why Stranger Things is so popular. He's a pop culture writer, a contributor to WBUR's The Artery, and also to the Boston Globe, and he wrote about nostalgia and the tropes in Stranger Things for Salon. Ethan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Great to be back.
Okay, so first of all, tell us a little bit about Stranger Things, a little summary of the plot.
Sure. So the story is set in a small fictional town in Indiana in 1983, and the action begins with four boys who are sitting around playing Dungeons and Dragons, and they're about 12, they're preteens, and one of the four of the quartet has a mysterious encounter with a supernatural force. I don't want to give away too much, but that sort of sets into motion a search for what happened to the kid, and the kids are on their own journey to figure out what happened, and there are also teenagers and adults as well who are trying to figure out what happens.
Okay, so 1983, you said. That's the key fact.
Yes.
There. That's when it's set. Why do you think this show has become so popular? Is it they're, you know, folks of my age, card-carrying Gen Xers maybe, or just feeling nostalgia for the 80s of our youth?
Well, it's a sweet spot for me. I'm a child of the 70s and the 80s. You know, I grew up watching a lot of the movies that this movie references. And came of age at this time. And I feel very much like there's a certain amount of, I think, interest in the 80s or some other series out there, whether it's the Goldbergs or the Americans that are set in the 80s, the new Ghostbusters reboot movie that came out this summer. So there's something in the air. I mean, there's some thoughts as to why that might be the case. But I think there is a whole generation of people who now are making films who grew up on these movies or rediscovered them. And it's part of like the lingua franca of their childhoods and of their world.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about that aspect of it, because there's kind of a tipping point between nostalgia and referencing, you know, pop culture memories of our youth and maybe exploiting them or beating you over the head with those tropes. Because, for example, in the beginning of the series, the kids in Stranger Things, they play Dungeons and Dragons, as you mentioned, and there's a reference to an opening scene from Spielberg's E.T. So first of all, let's listen to the original scene in E.T. where we have Steve, Mike, and Greg playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Five.
Oh, great.
So you got an arrow right in your chest and you're out 10 melee.
Oh, no.
Don't worry about it, Mike. I got resurrection. I'll bring you back.
I'm already one of the undead, Greg. I can still throw death spells, huh, Steve?
So that's from E.T., from Steven Spielberg's E.T. Now, there's a similar scene in Stranger Things where four preteen boys, Will, Mike, and Dustin and Lucas, are getting excited about their game.
Will, your action!
I don't know!
Fireball him!
They have to roll a 13 or higher!
Too risky!
Fireball him!
Cast protection!
The Demogorgon is tired of your silly human bickering! It stops towards you!
So is it, do you think that's too much of sort of echoing memories that we have from 80s pop culture, or is Dungeons and Dragons really serving the purpose here?
Well, I think in this case it does. I mean, and there's definitely a danger of this whole show sort of being a pointless or sort of soulless, you know, knockoff of a lot of Spielberg movies or this pointless nostalgia trip. But I feel like, you know, there's an element in which that serves as a way for us to establish who these four boys are. And also, in a way, the D&D setting or the session that they have at the beginning of that first episode sort of sets everything into motion and provides these kids with a sort of background to their character. We know that these kids are smart, they're introverted, sure, they're nerdy and they're being bullied, but the fact that they have this sort of secret knowledge of magic and how things might work outside of the view of adults sort of sets them onto their quest. I mean, they can sort of understand the world in ways that maybe adults can't, which is, of course, a classic trope from Spielberg and some of these other movies from the 80s, which is the kids are kind of running around on their bicycles with flashlights, investigating things. The Goonies is another good example.
Yeah.
And the adults are kind of clueless or inept. And I think that there's what's nice about the Stranger Things is it doesn't simply turn the whole series into an exploration of this, but there's an element in which this is kind of a way to set the plot into motion. But the series goes on and does much more interesting things with that idea than simply, you know, a sort of quaint little story of boys.
You know, once you mentioned the Goonies, all of a sudden I had in my mind images of a ghost pirate ship setting sail off into the distance in the waters of the Pacific Northwest. Because, I mean, it just goes to show like how deeply ingrained some of these movies and images and stories are from those of us who spent our formative years in the 80s. But in terms of the directors of Stranger Things, the Netflix series, brothers Matt and Ross Duffer, they were born in 1984.
That's right, yeah.
So these aren't necessarily their own memories. They're a little too young.
They're sort of memories of memories. I mean, their parents would be my age. I'm just about, you know, to turn 50. These guys, I originally assumed they were my age, and it turns out they were born a year after the story of Stranger Things even takes place. You know, they were born in 1984, so they're millennials.
Yeah. So totally, what do you think the attraction is for them to have set the story at this time period?
Well, I think there's a... I can't pretend to speak for all millennials because I'm not one, but it seems to me that there is an age that maybe some younger people are you know, hankering for, which is a pre-digital age, before helicopter parenting, before digital technology, where it was rotary phones and walkie-talkies and kids who kind of had a lot of free range, you know, parenting thrown at them, you could just go out the door and be gone for hours.
Ride your bike.
Ride your bike and
into the starlight.
Get into trouble.
Yeah.
And I think that's very, very appealing. I mean, in the age of Pokemon Go, where you're capturing imaginary monsters, in this show, they are trying to capture real ones.
Well, Ethan Gilsdorf is a contributor to WBUR's The Artery, and he's also a contributor to the Boston Globe, amongst others. He's author of the book Fantasy Freaks and Gaming Geeks, An Epic Quest for Reality Among Role Players, Online Gamers, and Other Dwellers of Imaginary Realms. You can find a link to Ethan's salon piece on Stranger Things at our website, radioboston.org. Ethan, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Magna.
And we're going to go out on the theme song from Stranger Things, composed by Kyle Dixon and Michael Stein. And that's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.